We present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey in Have His Carcass by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted for radio by Alistair Beaton, with Mariah Aitken as Harriet Vane and Nigel Stock as Inspector Umpletty. Episode 6, All a Question of Time.
Harriet Vane found herself comfortable in the quarters of the late Paul Alexis. When she ought to have been writing, Harriet would sit in an armchair reading a volume taken from Paul Alexis's bookshelf, with the idea of freeing the subconscious for the job of creating a new book. In this way, she imbibed a remarkable amount of miscellaneous information about the Russian imperial court. All this, of course, was a pure escape from the problem of explaining who killed Paul Alexis and why. Indeed, at this stage, Harriet merely seemed content to pour scorn on the elaborate theories put forward by Lord Peter and Inspector Umpletty. All efforts to break the alibi given by Henry Weldon, the chief suspect, had so far proved unsuccessful, and the police had even lost track of William Bright, who was a vital link in the chain of events leading to Alexis's death. One thing alone seemed clear, that there was some connection between the murder and the coded letters that Alexis had been receiving from abroad shortly before he died. Just as Lord Peter began to despair of ever finding a solution to the mystery, there came a development which had been long awaited.
Ah, Inspector! I came over right away when I heard the news. Where was the body found?
It was wedged in a deep crevice at the far end of the grinders. We had to bring it up by dredging tackle and diving. Tricky job. Not out any by a cash belt containing £300 in gold.
Aha, what did I tell you? Anything in the pockets?
Yes, my lord. Here's what we found. One British passport recently visaed for France. Then there was this leather note case in the breast pocket. It seems to have protected the contents from the sea pretty well. A few currency notes, some stamps, the return half of a ticket from Wolvercombe to Darley Holt, dated Thursday, 18th of June. And this. Careful, my lord. It's still not dried out fully.
Looks like a letter and cipher. And well preserved enough to be legible.
Doesn't make any sense to me, my lord, but if you think you can make sense on it...
Miss Vane and I shall immediately put our great brains to the business of deciphering it. Should you need me, Inspector, you will find me at Miss Vane's lodgings. Toodaloo.
Now, here's a problem to start with. What is in the letter, and why wasn't it burnt with the rest?
Yes, that is rather odd.
Very. This letter came on the Tuesday morning. On the Wednesday, bills were settled up, and on the Wednesday night, papers were burnt. On Thursday morning, Alexis set out to catch his train to Darley Holt. Is it too much to suppose that the instructions to do this were in the letter?
It looks likely. Well, we've got some idea of what must have been in the letter, and that'll be a great help with the decoding. We've also got an idea that the villain may have been a bit of an amateur, and that's borne out by the letter itself.
How?
Well, there are two lines here at the top of six letters apiece. Now, nobody but an amateur would present us with six isolated letters, let alone two sets of six. He'd run the whole show together. Well, I suggest that these words represent an address, or more probably an address and a date. They're in the right place for it. I don't mean a whole address, of course, just the name of a town, say Berlin or London, and the date below it.
It's possible.
Well, we can but try. Now, we don't know much about the town, except the letters are said to have come from Czechoslovakia. But we might get the date.
How would that be written?
Well, let's see. The letters RBEXMG may just represent the figures of the day, month and year. If they don't stand for numbers, then I suggest they may stand for June something teen in longhand. Now, let's see what date the letters may represent. Let's try this group first. Let's say that R represents... Well, let's think. Right, now we've got the date. The rest should be somewhat easier.
Could that be M?
Well, let's try it.
Don't joggle.
No, I must joggle. By Jove, you're right, Harriet. You're right! We're getting the key word, and with that we can crack the whole thing. Now then, let's have a look. M for mother. And O, N?
Yeah, we know N.
We do, yes.
A? R?
A-R. C? N and H. No, wait a jiffy, there's another letter here. Y. Monarchy! Monarchy, of course, three loud cheers.
Oh, Peter, how marvellous. Let's do a dance or something.
Nonsense, let's get on with the job. None of your frivolling now, down to the text.
All right. T.
Mm-hmm.
O.
Indeed.
H.
Yes.
I.
To
his serene. Can that be right?
Well, it's English. Look, hurry up, let's get those letters in there.
To his serene.
Highness! Bah!
Peter, what is all this about?
My God, can it be? Have we been wrong and the preposterous Mrs. Weldon been right? Shall I be reduced at my time of life to hunting down a Bolshevik gang? Read on, Harriet, read on.
Well, we've cracked it. But what on earth it means? Alexis always did say he was of noble birth, didn't he?
He did. And apparently found someone to believe him. Read it, Harriet, read it through.
To His Serene Highness, Grand Duke Pavel Alexeyevich, heir to the throne of the Romanovs. Papers entrusted to us by Your Highness, now thoroughly examined, and marriage of your illustrious ancestress to Tsar Nicholas I proved beyond doubt. All is in readiness. Your people, groaning under oppression of brutal Soviets, eagerly welcome return of imperial rule to Holy Russia. Treaty with Poland happily concluded. Money and arms at your disposal. Your presence alone needed. Spies at work, use caution. Burn all papers, all clues to identity. On Thursday, 18th June, take train reaching Darley Halt 10:15, walk by coast road to Flatiron Rock. There await rider from the sea who brings instructions for your journey to Warsaw. The word is empire. Bring this paper with you. Silence, secrecy imperative, Boris.
Well, one thing seems certain. Every theory I've so far formed about this case has been utterly and madly wide of the mark. Pavel Alexeyevich, heir to the throne of the Romanovs.
It's all very confusing. We've now got two unknown people to look for instead of one. The rider from the sea who stole the mare and was at the Flatiron about midday, and the murderer who was there at 2 o'clock.
Yes. Well, that seems to hang together reasonably well.
But it means we have to look for a quite new murderer, who had the opportunity of knowing about the appointment between Boris and Alexis. And it needn't be a Bolshevik. It might be somebody with a private motive for doing away with Alexis. How about the De Soto gentleman who took up with Layla Garland after she dropped Paul Alexis? Layla may have told De Soto some nasty story about Alexis.
True. Only we happen to know that De Soto was playing at the Winter Gardens all that time. But now I want to look at the thing from a quite different point of view. What about this coded letter? Is it genuine? If it really comes from a foreign gentleman of the name of Boris, why is it written in English? Then again, all that opening stuff about brutal Soviets and Holy Russia is so vague and sketchy. It doesn't ring true, Harriet. It doesn't look like business. It looks like somebody with a very sketchy idea of the way revolutions really work trying to flatter that poor boob's monomania about his birth.
In fact, you think the letter looks like a trap.
Yes, but it's difficult to be sure. And even then, who sent it and why? Well, I shall hand the decoded letter over to Umpletty. That'll give him something to think about. I like to see other people doing a spot of work from time to time. I say, Harriet.
Yes?
What would you say was the most convenient part of Henry Weldon's alibi?
I don't know. Well, I suppose it was rather convenient that his car should break down.
Precisely. My very thoughts. If the inspector should telephone, kindly tell him I've gone over to talk to Paul Whistler at the garage and that I shall be at the station directly. Cheerio.
Why, yes, my lord. It was a fairly straightforward job. The fault was in the HT leads, all right. We tried the mag, and she was working top hole, and there wasn't nothing wrong with the plug, so after we fiddle about a bit more, young Tom says, here, I'll get him over for you. Tom?
Huh?
Come over here for a moment.
Afternoon, my lord.
Afternoon, Tom.
That Morgan that we was fixing up a couple of weeks back, fault were in the HT leads, weren't it?
Ah, that's right. I says to this Mr. Martin, how about the HT leads? And Mr. Martin, he says, that's an idea. And before I could say knife, he whips the leads out of the clip and gets them off.
So you replaced them?
Well, sir, I were going to take a look at them. Never mind looking at the blasted things, he says. You can't do no bloody good by looking at them, he says. Shoving a new pair and look smart.
So you did?
Yes, my lord.
Did you actually examine the leads afterwards?
Oh, now you ask me, I don't rightly know what happened to them leads.
Ah, but I know. When Mr. Martin went to start up the engine, he pushed them leads into his pocket, careless-like. And when he pulled out his handkerchief to wipe the oil off his fingers, them leads fall out on the grass. And I picks them up, being a tidy-minded man, and drops them in my tool bag, thinking as though they might come in useful.
I'd like to have a look at them.
Nothing easier. Let's have a look now. And here they do be, which just shows what it is to be a tidy-minded man.
Thank you. Yes, they seem to be fused together just where they pass under the clip.
Huh?
Nothing wrong with the insulation there, apparently. Hello, hello, hello. Here's your trouble. Looks like the business end of a sewing needle. Give us a sharp knife and we'll soon see. There you are. Now, have a look at that.
Well, there now. To think of that.
The needle's obviously been passed through the lead and then broken off short so as to leave no visible trace of his presence.
Yeah.
When the two leads are in place side by side, the needle passes through both, bridges the circuit and shorts the spark.
Oh, this beats me, this does.
I've seen it done before. It's a very handy way of holding up a motorcyclist at the beginning of a race, for example. Oh. Look here, you two. Don't say a word about this to anyone.
We did surely ought to find out who it was that was monkeying about with a gentleman's car.
No, I'll take the thing up myself, if necessary.
Very well, sir.
And, thank you so much for your help.
Oh, thank you, my lord.
I have to admit it, my lord. This decoded letter of yours puts a new complexion on things, and no mistake.
Don't it?
And so does the news from Scotland Yard.
Yes?
They've tracked down Bright to a house in London.
Excellent.
Where he's living under the name of Morecambe.
Morecambe?
Mm.
Great Scott, the name of the woman who gave Weldon his lift into Wilverkin. The lady who provided Weldon with his alibi.
Yes. It appears that Bright is, in fact, Morecambe, husband of the same lady. And what's more, we've got information to the effect that Morecambe visited Weldon on his farm last February. Which pretty well clinches it. Morecambe and Weldon are in cahoots together.
Excuse me, Inspector. My lord, Miss Vane's here.
Thank you, Saunders. Send her in.
Yes, sir. This way, miss.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Aha! I think I see a gleam in Miss Vane's eye that suggests she is about to put one over on us. Speak, tell us all.
Henry Weldon was not doing anything nefarious in Wilvercombe on Thursday the 18th. I went to the men's outfitting where Weldon said he got his collars. He didn't. Mrs. Morecambe got them for him. The assistant had taken the parcel out to the car, which was empty. I then went to the Winter Gardens and discovered that Mrs. Morecambe was at that concert. I found an attendant who remembered her by her appearance and get-up. And she was taking notes.
Of the programme. For Weldon, of course.
After that, I tried the bobby on point duty in the Market Square. Such a nice, intelligent bobby. He remembered the car because of the funny number plate. And he noticed that there was no one in it except the lady driving. Henry Weldon wasn't in Wilvercombe that day.
No, and it's pretty clear now where he was. He was riding that damn mare along the beach. Out at 11 o'clock and back at 12:30 or thereabouts.
That's clear too. He was the rider from the sea, but he still didn't kill Paul Alexis, because the murder was done at 2 o'clock. And we know no one passed along that beach near 2 o'clock. You realise, Inspector, that the longer we leave Morecambe to himself, the more time he's got to make away with the evidence.
What evidence?
Well, if Alexis replied to all those coded letters that Morecambe was sending him, it's possible that Morecambe still has Alexis's letters in his possession.
Maybe you're right, my lord, and we ought to pull him in. Only, you'll bear in mind that if we do detain him, we'll have to make a charge. There's such a thing as habeas corpus.
All the same, I think you'll have to risk that. As for me, I'll have to do something drastic to restore my self-respect. Seek in the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth.
Oh, yeah? When Lord Peter gets these fits of quotations, he's usually on to something.
Says you. I'm going straight away to make love to Leila Garland.
Well, watch out for De Soto.
I'll chance De Soto. I shall appear in my famous impersonation of a lounge lizard. Imitation très difficile. I'll see you later.
Cheerio.
Well, of course, Mr. Alexis was a dear boy and always a perfect gentleman, but hardly a manly man. I do think, don't you, Lord Peter, that it is much finer to be a noble-born person who really does things than a noble-born person who only talks nobility.
But was Alexis nobly born, Miss Garland?
Well, Lord Peter, he said he was, but how's a girl to know? Here you are, I said, not earning half as much money as some people I could name. And what good does it do you, even if you're the Tsar of Russia, I said.
Did he say he was the Tsar of Russia?
Oh, no. He only said that if his great-great-grandmother had married somebody or other, he might have been somebody important.
Who did he think his great-great-grandmother was, then?
Oh, sure, I don't know. Oh, he did go on. He wrote it all down for me one day, but I said to him, "You make my head ache," I said. "And besides, from what you say, none of your people were any better than they should have been."
He seems to have given more thought to the thing than it was worth. Wrote it all down, did he?
Yes, he did. And then one day he came bothering me about it again. Wanted it back. "If you want things kept," I said, "why don't you give them to that old woman who's so stuck on you?" And he said he particularly didn't want the paper kept. He wanted it burnt. He told me he didn't want me to talk to anybody about his great-great-grandmother and all that stuff. Silly, I call it.
And did you burn the paper?
Well, I'm sure I don't know. You're nearly as bad as he was going on about that piece of paper. What does a stupid paper matter, anyhow?
Well, I'm inquisitive about papers. Still, if you've burnt it, you've burnt it. It's a pity. If you could have found that paper, it might be worth...
Yes?
It might be worth having a look at. Perhaps if you had a hunt among your odds and ends, you know...
I can't see what you want that old bit of paper for.
Nor do I, until I see it. But we might have a shot at looking for it, eh, what? There it is, Harriet. The precious piece of paper. Alexis's family tree, so-called. Obtained at great cost to my patience and dignity, I may add.
Good Lord. But it's simply silly, Peter. Even if Alexis's great-great-grandmother had been married to Nicholas the First 50 times over, he wouldn't have been heir to the throne. Why, there are heaps and heaps of people nearer than he was. This little family tree of his is just a nonsense, that's all.
Well, of course, but you can always persuade people into believing what they want to, you know.
Anyhow, it's perfectly clear now how the trap was baited. Only we could get hold of the letter that Alexis sent to Boris.
Well, Umpleton's taken care of Boris. That is to say, Morecambe. There's a warrant out for his arrest. But I fear he'll have destroyed those letters by now, as sure as eggs is eggs.
You'll allow it's a bit awkward, my lord. Fetching people up and charging them with being accomplices to murder, which we can't even prove is a murder. We've got to come up with something quick.
I freely admit, Inspector, that it's the queerest case I ever struck. We've got evidence of an elaborate conspiracy to do something or other, and we've got a corpse which looks like the victim of a conspiracy to murder. But when we come to put the two together, they don't fit.
Suppose, for instance, that Paul Alexis is really...
the Emperor of Japan.
Well, that might not be so far off. He thought he was an emperor, or next door to it, anyhow. Though even if he had 50 pints of imperial blood in his veins instead of only 2 or 3, it wouldn't help to explain why...
Wait a minute. Say that again.
Well, the real difficulty
The real difficulty is the time of the death, ain't it?
Well, yes, I suppose it is.
Well, of course it is. If it wasn't for that, we could explain everything. You know, I always thought it was funny if Henry Welland did the murder, that he didn't seem to know at what time he did it. Look, let's pretend we've planned this murder for ourselves and have timed it for 12 o'clock.
But what's the good of that, my lord? We know it wasn't actually done till 2 o'clock.
Ah, but I want to look at the original murder as it was planned. Do you mind? I want to. It's February. You are Henry Weldon. You've just heard that your elderly and foolish mother is going to marry a dancing dago 35 years younger than herself and disinherit you. You are badly in need of money, and you want to stop this at all costs. You make yourself unpleasant, but you find it's no good. You'll only lose all the money instead of part of it. You're not an inventive man yourself, so you consult Morecambe.
So Weldon and Morecambe work out the plot about the coded letters?
Yes. Obviously, Mrs. Morecambe was the source of information about the topography and fauna of Wolvercombe and Darley. Weldon was chosen to do the throat-cutting and horse-riding part of it, which needed brawn only, while Morecambe buzzed about dispatching letters via someone in Czechoslovakia and working Alexis up to the top notch of excitement. Then, when everything is about ready, Morecambe goes off to take up his role of travelling hairdresser and calls himself William Bright, so as to avoid any danger of the purchase of the razor being traced back to him.
I see. Well, go on.
Now for Weldon. He had his character of Haviland Martin all ready to slip into. He hired a Morgan and went to camp at Darley near the field of the bay mare. On Thursday, Alexis goes off to the Flatiron in search of an imperial crown. Meanwhile, Henry Weldon has run a needle through the H.T. Leeds of the Morgan so as to provide a very good reason for asking for a lift into Wilvercombe.
But he didn't go into Wilvercombe.
No. Mrs. Morgan puts Weldon down out of sight of the village and the passing throng at some point where he can cut across the fields to the shore again. He goes into the field where the mare is, carrying a bridle rope, which he later burns, or tries to burn. He also makes a gap in the hedge to explain why the mare should later be found running loose.
Then he rides along the beach and cuts Alexis's throat for him.
Correct. Alexis is sitting on the rock, dreaming of the imperial purple, and then there comes the rider from the sea. He may or may not recognise Weldon, but by that time it's too late. Weldon has tied the mare to the ringbolt put there the day before. The mare goes frantic at the sight and smell of the blood.
Which is why she wouldn't approach the Flatiron when you tried later.
You can't put horses in the witness box. I don't want to waste any more time on this. I only wish I'd never touched the bleeding case.
But you are so hasty, Inspector. I admit the plan went wrong. But I never said they didn't carry it out.
Well, my lord, whatever they didn't murder Alexis at 2 o'clock because they weren't there to do it. And they didn't murder him at 12 o'clock because he didn't die till 2. Now, those are facts, aren't they?
No.
No?
No.
You mean one or other of them was there at 2 o'clock?
No.
You mean they did murder Alexis at 12 o'clock?
Yes.
Well, by cutting his throat?
Yes.
Right through?
Right through.
Then how is it he didn't die till 2 o'clock?
We have no evidence at all as to the time Alexis did die.
Well, I'll be...
Something you said about blood, Harriet. Look, let's recall a few things we know about the supposed heir to the throne of the Romanovs. He is known to have been very ill as a child through being knocked down in the playground. At the age of 21, he wore a beard and had never used a razor. He was extraordinarily timid about using sharp weapons or visiting the dentist. On Thursday the 18th, when scrambling over rocks, he wore gloves. Periodic pains in his joints caused him suffering. He used antiprin to relieve this condition. And finally, one may inherit other things besides imperial crowns.
Of course. I thought your style was a little laboured in places, but as an impromptu effort, it's creditable.
What is all this?
Oh, don't tease him, Peter.
You will have your fun, my lord, but...
Haemophilia.
Haemophilia? What in the name of blazes is that when it's at home?
It's a condition of the blood due to lack of, oh, something or other. And so far as is known, it is incurable.
Oh, what is it? And why do you think Alexis had it? And what does it matter if he did?
It's a condition in which the blood doesn't clot properly. If you get even a tiny scratch, you may bleed to death from it. And if you get a fall or a blow, you have internal bleeding, which comes out in great lumps and swellings and is horribly painful and gives you a hell of a fever. Hence, if I remember rightly, the antiprin.
The Tsarevich had it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I read about it in those books of Alexis. But like a fool, I never thought about it in connection with the murder.
Oh, I don't know that I see it now. Except that it explains why Alexis was such a namby-pamby. Do you mean that it proves Alexis really was royalty of sorts?
It may or may not prove any of that. But don't you see, my dear old goat, that it completely busts up and spifflicates the medical evidence? We timed the death for 2 o'clock because the blood hadn't clotted. But if Alexis was a haemophiliac, you might wait till kingdom come and his blood would never clot at all. Therefore, he may have died at noon, or dawn, for all we know.
But here's a snag.
Mm-hmm.
If he might have died any time, how are we to prove he died at 12 o'clock?
Easy. First of all, we know it must have been then, because that's the time for which these people have an alibi. As Sherlock Holmes says somewhere, only a man with a criminal enterprise desires to establish an alibi. I must say this case is really unique in one thing. It's the only one I have ever known in which a murderer didn't know the time at which he was supposed to have done the murder.
It's funny the way all this worked out for Weldon and Co. They had such good luck in one way and such bad luck in another. I mean, first of all, they had an alibi and a disguise. And then all my unnecessary cleverness and observation gave them a far better alibi for a totally different time, which was good luck. Then, when to their horror their original alibi turned out to be useless and dangerous, along comes poor little Perkins the hiker, who of course was as innocent as any sucking pig, and gives them a cast-iron alibi for the wrong time. It's so complicated, I don't really know whether my being here helped or hindered.
It's so complicated that I'm not certain we'll get any jury to believe it. See here, my lord, if we do prosecute, do you really think we've a hope in Hades?
I'll tell you this, Inspector. Last night, Mrs. Weldon consented to dance with Monsieur Antoine, and Henry didn't like it at all. If you let Henry Weldon and Morecambe loose again, what premium would you take on those two lives, Antoine's and Mrs. Weldon's?
I dare say you're right. Well, there's nothing else for it. I shall have to go to the chief constable and win him over to our way of seeing things. And that's not going to be easy, my lord.
Well,
isn't that a damned awful, bitter, bloody farce, hmm? The old fool who wanted a lover and the young fool who wanted an empire. One throat cut and three people hanged. And £130,000 going begging for the next man who likes to sell his body and soul for it. God, what a jape. King Death has ass's ears with a vengeance. Let's clear out of this, Harriet. Get your things packed and leave your address to the police and come up to town. I'm fed up to the back teeth.
Yes, let's go. I'm terrified of meeting Mrs. Weldon, and I don't want to see Antoine. It's all frightening and disgusting. We'll go home.
Righty-ho. We'll go home. We'll dine in Piccadilly. Damn it, I always did hate watering places.
In that final episode of Have His Carcass, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael, Harriet Vane, Mariah Aitken, Inspector Umpleby, Nigel Stock, Layla Garland, Rosalind Ayers, Saunders, John Webb, Paul Whistle, Alan Dudley, Tom, Andrew Seacombe, and the narrator, John Westbrook. Have His Carcass was adapted by Alistair Beaton from the book by Dorothy L. Sayers, and was produced by Martin Fisher.